Shalom Aleichem, Chavetz Binyamin Hammer, the National Council of Young Israel. We thank Rebbe for being on the call. This is conference call number 68. Thank you, Rebbe.
You're very welcome. Question number one. How concerned are we that a pregnant woman should not walk on nail clippings due to the risk of miscarriage? I know of one rabbi that tells his congregants not to go into a nail salon to get manicures, pedicures while pregnant, due to the concern that there are nail droppings, dippings, and clippings on the floor. What if a woman is cutting her nails and she thinks one of them may have fallen on the floor, but she's not sure, what should she do? So the Gemara is in Masechta Mo'ed Katan Daf Yud Ches Amud Aleph that if a woman steps on or walks over nails, it could cause a miscarriage. The Mishnah Berurah quotes us in Siman Reish Samach Sif Katan Vav, and he says it's an Eitzah to, based on the Gemara there, to sweep it into a different place. Some require a different room. Some of you say just move it out of its place. And the question is, how concerned? So someone who's concerned about what the Gemara says should be concerned. Is there any room to not be concerned? So it's difficult to answer these questions. They're not clear. In the Pitzke Chuvus, for example, in discussing this issue in Siman Reish Samach, he links the issue of nails with the issue of Ruach Ra in general and questions whether it applies to non-Jews, things of this nature. And with respect to the Ruach Ra that of the morning, there are those poskim who say that nowadays things have changed, Nishtana Watvoyim, it comes to things which are linked to Shadim. The Gemara has an expression of Psochim, Lo Kopa Lo Kavdinale, if you don't care about it, it won't bother you. And there are some, therefore, who presumably would extend this to our situation as well. So how concerned, as concerned as she is, if she's concerned that it's going to be a problem, she should worry about it, and she shouldn't go into the nail salon. If she's not concerned, then perhaps, based on what we said until now, there's room to be more lenient. If it's in the house, sweeping it to a different place should suffice. To be even more strict, sweep it to a different room. Question two. Chicken was cooked in a glass pan and was then placed on a part of a table on a towel to cool. A while later, when the woman checked the chicken, she noticed that the towel was wet, that under the towel the table was also moist. Is the table not considered fleshic? What if the hot glass pan was put directly on the table? So here's the issue. The Gemara tells us, the Rishonim say, the Poskim quote it, Ein balua yotze mikli likli belo rotev, that whatever is absorbed in one vessel will not leave that vessel and go into a different vessel without the medium of rotev, something which is liquid. There's a big dispute between the Chavos Das and the Yad Yehuda as to the details of what this means. According to the Chavos Das, fundamentally it has to be a puddle, a lot of water, a lot of liquid, in order to facilitate the transfer of taste from the, we'll call it from the pot into the surface below. And that's why in many cases we can be make, according to the Chavos Das, ovens and grates, things of this nature, mikir adin, there's room to be mekel. We all know about a grate, the Gemara, the Mechaber says in Hichos Pesach, Hatzuva Tzricha Libun, that a grate should be kashet for Pesach, the Mefarshim, the Mishnah Berurah, they say it's a chumra v'yalma, by strict law, it's not necessary because Ein balua yotze mikli likli b'larotev. And even though a little bit of liquid may emerge from the pot somehow or other, from the top or from some other way, and intervene between the pot and the grate, it's a tiny amount, and it's not considered to be sufficient for the perspective of the Chavos Das. The Yad Yehuda disagrees. He has a much more strict view and says that even if a small amount of liquid will intervene between one surface and the other, that's considered to be a sufficient rotev for the balua to exit clean number one and go on to clean number two. Our situation presumably depends upon this dispute. What happens is you have a little moisture, a little nothing. So according to the Chavos Das, the balua in the fleshic pot, but has the chicken in it, cannot get from the pot into the table, notwithstanding that there's some moisture under the towel. Called Yad Yehuda, it may be a problem. The tailor might be considered fleshik, and then you'll have another problem if there's a subsequent spill. If the hot glass pan is directly on the table and it's dry, so then we assume, as I mentioned earlier, that balua does not go from kli to kli below rotif. It's a little bit wet, same dispute between the Yad Yehuda who is strict and the Chavasatz who's lenient. Question 3. Many people use CPAP machines to help them sleep at night, sleep apnea. Some machines must be turned on before the mask is placed on the face. Other machines automatically turn on when the mask is placed on the face and the person begins to breathe. On Shabbos, how can one use the CPAP machines? While the first one can be set on a Shabbos clock, the second one cannot. Can the second type of mask be used? Should a person cover the screen, which has numbers and symbols that the layman doesn't really understand anyway? Clearly, if a Shabbos clock can be used, that's preferred. If you have a machine which simply cannot use a Shabbos clock, so again, it depends. If it's a chola sheyesh bo sakana, there's a chance of danger, then of course everything is mutter. Ideally, you should do things with a shinui, which means if you, instead of pressing the button with your finger, press it with the back of your knuckle, things of this nature. If it's a chola sheyesh bo sakana, presumably an individual who must resort to a CPAP machine means that without the CPAP machine, they cannot function normally. They don't get enough sleep. Their breathing is labored. And it could even be, you know, somewhat dangerous to their health. That's a chol hashem basakana. And then the psak is that it's mutter to do bishinui. The rabbonans can certainly do bishinui. And presumably over here, they're presumably only the rabbonans. And according to one opinion, even if there would be a deraisa, it would still be permissible to do a bishinui. So again, chol hashem basakana is mutter, but you should still prefer a shinui. Chol hashem basakana may only be done if you use a shinui. Question 4. Regarding minor fasts, on Gudaya, Sabbateva, Shivasa, Batamas, and Titus Esther, often rabbis are asked whether a person may eat or drink for non-medical reasons. For example, a person who cannot function at work, doctor, nurse, lawyer, person working outside, or a person experiencing anxiety due to some stressful life event, etc. What are the basic guidelines regarding those who may be exempt from these fasts, aside from those who are sick or pregnant or a nursing woman? Well, strict halacha says, quote in Shulchan Aruch, that we're all obligated to fast on these fasts, except for the exceptions that you just mentioned, sick or nursing or pregnant women. So therefore, everyone should fast. If an individual is fasting and finds him or herself in a situation of becoming a chol hashem basakana, then of course you can break the fast. Otherwise, you know, tough it out. A person's a lawyer. Lawyers work hard. Other people also work hard. So I don't see it as a reason to not fast just because you happen to be a lawyer. Doctors and nurses, if they can't do their job properly, that's a bigger cooler because they're saving lives. But if they're able to get through the day, they should not break the fast. So working outside, it depends on which fast it is. Right? If it's Shavasa Batamas, which is the peak of the summer, there may be a fear of dehydration. If you can't take off from work, being in the hot sun, of course you're allowed to break the fast in such a case. There's no blanket head to break this minor fast just because you're a doctor, nurse, lawyer, or working outside. Now, there is an opinion which is more lenient with respect to women. In some places, women presumably of childbearing age, even if they're not pregnant and not nursing, had a custom not to fast, and those who have that custom, we can't argue with it, but it's not the prevailing custom, and someone who does that should do it privately, and certainly when you're not in that age range, and certainly men, it's not appropriate to be lenient here unless there's a clear medical reason. They should always try to do it in private. Now, the briskers have their own way of doing things. Some of the briskers say, based on the technical language of the Gemara, Ratzu Ein Mesanin, that they decide not to fast for reasons of their own. That's a very minority view, and It all comes along with many, many chumras of risk. A person should not pick and choose. So the bottom line, everyone should fast on these days, unless there's a medical reason not to. And if there is a medical reason not to, you should break the fast immediately. Question number five. A frum teacher's aide in Arabtown Day School was asked by one of her kids in her classroom to open up a snack for them, as the packaging could be challenging for a little child to open. The day school policy is children are permitted to bring their own snacks and food from home except for any meat or meat byproducts. But milk is allowed. In this case, cheese, but other snacks for sure, don't have hashgacha on the package and can often be outright treif. Question, is it a problem of lifnei iver or at least misayelet varavera to assist and by the administration for not doing part of a job which would be to be assist children with such needs? Lifnei iver it's not, because they could do it without your help. Even if this young child can probably get to it by herself or himself in a little while. Misayaya is a problem. You're assisting someone to do something which is sinful, and that's a problem. I would say if it's outright treif, the teacher's aide should say, I'm sorry, I can't do it. I cannot give outright treif of food to a Jewish child. It's against my principles. The school has no right to reprimand her because she's doing the right thing. However, most cases, I imagine, are just, we'll say, don't have hashgacha. Don't have hashgacha is a whole different story. Quick look at the ingredients. There's nothing really, really treif. You and I would need it. We're afraid of all kinds of little flavors here and there and other conscious problems. But the problems are minimal enough so that even though the teacher's aide herself should certainly not partake, there's room to be more lenient in such a case if the job demands it, to assist somewhat in opening the bag. Don't give the child the food in the hand. That's a worse problem. Just to open it, there's room in such a case to be somewhat lenient, if only if absolutely necessary. Six, does a school building where they teach both Kodesh and Chol subjects need a mezuzah? The answer is yes. Our general principle is that schools require mezuzahs. The subject matter is not of concern. Kodesh and Chol. Either one would be chayv and mezuzah, b'pshuta. And the room should have a mezuzah. Question seven. When staying in the New York City Manhattan Hospital for Shabbos, can I, A, walk outside with a baby bracelet or patient ID tag? Or the svara that the baby bracelet is considered a takshit? Because the dad is happy, proud to wear it, since it indicates he is a new father. B, ask a non-Jew to press the elevator to go down to daven with a minion to get food or just walk around the hospital. C, can I ask a non-Jew to press the floor button in the elevator once they call the elevator? And who, any other issues they're aware of while being in a hospital for Shabbos, people should be aware of. Okay. The first question is the most difficult. There are the children of Rav Moshe, Igros Moshe Erochaim Chelik Aleph Simon Kuf Yud Aleph, which he permits wearing a wristwatch, Mikir Adin, with no Eruv. He said they should try to be strict. The logic of Rav Moshe is that whatever is directly on the body and wrapped around the body, on your wrist, is considered to be a malbush. We wouldn't call it that in our language. In halachic terminology, it's like a malbush, it's like a garment, like a wristband on your wrist. Which would presumably be permissible. That's what Moshe's psak, the Yerei Shemayim, said should be strict. Number one, there are many disputes of Moshe. Number two, there were those who claimed that even Rav Moshe's kula would not apply to the bracelet of patient ID tag on the person's wrist. So therefore, if it's possible to avoid using it, you should avoid using it if there's no Eruv. On the other hand, if it's impossible, you have to walk outside and you have to come back and there's no Eruv. And if you take it off, they want it back in again. Now, they're very careful about security. There's room to be made, in my opinion, based on an extension of a merchant's shuvah. As far as non-Jew, you may ask a non-Jew to do anything because you are helping out a chole, and therefore there's room to be, whatever your needs are, you can be lenient. Getting food for sure is certainly needed for you to help continue to take care of the chole. And if you ask me, even the other needs, going to a minyan or walking around the hospital, will enable you to better take care of the chola. You're used to your spiritual and physical comforts, and the threshold is pretty low because the prohibition is very lenient to ask a goy to do something, since whatever is necessary to help out a chol l'shem b'sakana can be done through a goy, and in my view, can even you're not directly going telling the goy to press the elevator button in order to get something for the patient, but it's something for you as someone who's helping the patient. I believe there's room to be lenient there as well. And yes, you can ask the non-Jew to press the floor button as well. Other issues? Well, one issue is they're allowed to carry in the hospital. Is there a problem of Hotzah? You need an Erev Chatzeres. There's more than one Jew in the hospital, almost with certainty. My view is the answer is no. And the reason being that a person's room in a hospital is not rented. They give you a room. If they want, they can change you from room to room. If you look in one of the Sforas of Tosfos Masechet Erevin, a similar case. If they can move you from place to place, this does not constitute a sufficient level of control to be considered someone who actually lives there to require an Erev Chatzeres. That's one problem which can certainly exist. But in my opinion, it's permissible. I'm sure there are unlimited problems that can come up in a hospital. You have to be aware that pikuach nefesh is docha Shabbos for sure. Don't ask many questions. Just do what has to be done. You can do it yourself. You don't have to look for a nachri unless a nachri is standing right there. And if you do it yourself, it's better to do it b'shinui. If you do it through a nachri or b'shinui, you should announce. Shlomo Zalman demands you announce, I'm doing it with a nachri, with a shinui, only because they happen to be there. But if they would not be here, I would do it myself, because it's a shash sakana. Even a remote chashash sakana is docha Shabbos. V'chol she'ein bo sakana, that's a different story. There, as was mentioned, things have to be done b'shinui. Again, according to the Mechaber, only the Rabbanan's b'shinui. According to the Shulchan Aruch Harav, even the Raisis can be done b'shinui. I think that's one could rely upon that opinion, the second and more lenient opinion, when necessary. We can spend a whole day on hospitals, but we'll go on to the next question. 8. A single Jewish woman has asked me to perform a bris on her soon-to-be-born child that is a product of a fertilized egg implanted in her by her fertility specialist. Being that there's practically no chance that the fertilized egg comes from a Jewish donor, what is the status of the child? What is the psak on surrogate motherhood? Here too, we can spend a day on this topic. Who is the mother? Is the mother the birth mother? In which case, we have no problem in our situation, because here, the birth mother is Jewish. Or is the, we call the genetic mother, the mother, the egg donor, is she the mother? And she's the mother, so we have a major situation on our hands. This is a question which no one's going to resolve definitively anytime soon. There are various Gemaras in Masechta Yevamos, which the poskim quote to try to prove one way or the other. One Gemara on Daf Tzadikas discussing a situation of twins that their mother converted while pregnant with them, and there seems to be some issue which takes effect, relationship takes effect at the time of the birth, even though when they were conceived, the mother was not Jewish, and she went to conversion, and now she became Jewish, so we would say that any relationship between the twins should be severed, cut and shenola dummy, yet the Gemara implies that it's not the case. So some want to say, based on that the birth mother is critical. If you look at Rashi there, I think more in Rashi Tzadikas Nivamas, he says that in this case, you do not apply Kekot and Shinola Dami. So some say Fakert. If you would say Kekot and Shinola Dami, there would be no relationship between the brothers. You see that the birth does not create the relationship. I don't believe that's true either. I don't think it's true either, because there would be no proof. Not going into the details of the Gemara, it seems that Gemara proves nothing. Neither direction. There's another Gemara, which says that a woman who converts in pregnancy, her son does not require a tevila. The tevila of the mother works for the fetus. And we see from here, and the reason is because the mother's body is not a chatzitza. We see from here that if the mother who gives birth is not a mother, because if the birth mother determines whether you're Jewish or not, who cares whether the conversion in utero was valid or not? It's irrelevant. The child is born, the mother is Jewish. So by definition, you're born to a Jewish mother, you're Jewish. See from this Gemara the other way around, that being born to a Jewish mother does not suffice to make you Jewish. Now, there are those who claim there's no mother or two mothers. That's science fiction. There's either one mother. There's either the mother, the birth mother, or the genetic mother. So this would seem to indicate that the birth mother is not a mother, and therefore the genetic mother is a mother. It may depend on the question what's called uber yerech imo, uber lav yerech imo. It seems to me that, if anything, my view is, it's leaning towards the genetic mother. I'm told Rav Yoshev said that, although quoted different ways. He said that the fetus is a natural incubator, but it's really the woman who donated the egg that's considered the halachic mother. If that's the case, which it very well may be, let us now go back to our question. Assuming that this birth mother got an egg donor from a non-Jewish donor, it's a problem. So we don't know. So the male has to do the bris. Because since no one knows for sure, the child may be Jewish, may be not Jewish. So the male should perform the bris milah conditionally. If the baby is Jewish, there should be a regular bris. If the baby is not Jewish, it should be a first step in a conversion process. Of course, conversion process requires certain minimal standards. This mother, a little bit suspect whether she has these standards given what she did. Nonetheless, I think the mother can still do the bris milah because at some future date, perhaps the child may have the geiris. And there are those who claim that even growing up in a non-observant environment is still considered to be a schus, good for you, rather than be a non-Jew. So it's unresolved doubts, and therefore the bila should be done. The bracha is a problem. The bracha is not only a problem in this funny case, which is really outrageous if you ask me, but in a much more common case. A couple is married, and she has no eggs. Her eggs are no good. So they use a donor egg, and they have children in the context of a marriage. Now what do you do? So of course, you must do the bris for the same reasons as before. What about the bracha? I was once at such a bris, and I had to stand there with two others to constitute a bezdin, in case, as in my view is likely, there needs to be a subsequent tevila and a tevila shel geirus. The male, who I think was clued into this, was told this, despite that made a bracha of al hamila, which is a bracha for an eight-day-old baby or for a Jewish-born baby, instead of lama l'sagerim. We can't have pinus, as we'll say, because to make lama l'sagerim is also a problem. Maybe the child is born Jewish. One could argue al hamila of a regular Jewish child, so therefore al hamila is a safer bet, unless you want to have no bracha, which is not so easy to do, and especially in public settings when not everyone knows that there's a donor egg over here. The bracha of the father, lachnisa, which is also said in the case I attended, is more questionable. And the bracha of kores abris, similarly. But maybe they worry about kavod abris, then they can say brachas, which may not be directly on point in such a case. But again, it's a serious question as far as the bracha is concerned. Number 9. Was the bracha on breaded schnitzel, breaded chicken? How about on sushi? So, this is also a very serious, serious question. What to do in such a case? Much ink has been spilled about sushi. The general rule is, Iker and Tuffel, you'll follow the majority. So I'm assuming there's more chicken, more fish than the covering, but there's a problem. The covering is usually made from flour, and that's what's called chameshes aminim, one of the five species. This is assumed means wheat flour, and it's called breading. That's what we're discussing. This breaded chicken, so bread is obviously made from flour. So there's a Gemara has a koshi, which is made from chameshes aminim. Koshi yeshua me chameshes aminim, says the Gemara. If it has some of chameshes aminim, that bracha is determinant. You make mizonos, even though the quantitative majority is something else, such as chicken or fish. And the questions that apply in this circumstance or not. So that's a very, very complex matter. Because of Iker and Tuffel. Shulchan Aruch writes in Reish Yud Beis, Merkachas Shemenichen Arikikim Dakim, Osim Rikikim Havitfeil the Merkachas, Shadova Yadua Shein Kamiskavdim Lecholechem. What does that mean? You shouldn't want to get your hands dirty. You know, the honey is dirty and sticky. So you really want to eat honey. So that's just something that's like a spoon. It's like a spoon. Then the bracha would be on the honey, not on the little cracker. Now, the Shalah says you would make a bracha on the honey, even if the cracker is delicious. It's honey cake. Sounds like it's against the Magen Avraham. It's not just a spoon. So here's the Shalom referring to a case. Well, the Rabbi writes, "Shemechaven she'ein o'ocho elim is shemekachas lechut." Seems to me that based on this, if there are two foods, and you would eat is A and B, you would eat A by itself, but you wouldn't eat B by itself. Then you make a brach on A, even if B is chamesh asamin. Here, schnitzel. You would have chicken by yourself, probably healthy if you would have grilled chicken, but you wouldn't have the breading by itself, I sure hope not. So therefore, the bracha should be shahakol. That's my psak. The bracha should be shahakol. Not everyone agrees. If you look at the Piskei Tshuvos, there in Kuf, Reishit Beis of Kohen Beis, there's a long, long discussion. It gives five klolim, which are, again, complex. He claims, he quotes the rule we just said, that if it's A and B, and you would have A without B, but not B without A, you make a bracha on A. But then he claims that that rule is overridden by chameshes aminim, and therefore, if that would be the case, you make a bracha of mizonos on the schnitzel. And he quotes a Mishnah Berurah. But the Mishnah Berurah is referring to a case where they are mixed together. One on top of the other, it seems to me that the rule, you have A without B and B without A, would apply even to overcome chameshes aminim, as Eli Rabbah seems to say. And that's shat neshalah. That's what I think. Not everyone agrees. If I'm right, schnitzel is shahakol, and many poskim say this way. I saw this in the book called Birchas Hanenah by Rabbi Stern. Shahakol, based on the shalal that I just mentioned, that the Shulchan Aruch Harav says something similar. Rabbi Fourth Shalita disagrees, and he says the bracha to be made is Boromin and Mazonos, because Kol Sheshu Mechamesh Saminim. So, you know, I big dispute, and you look at all the books talk about it and come to different conclusions. Again, my personal view is it should be shahakal, but others disagree. That's as far as schnitzel is concerned. Sushi, I'm told there are many kinds of sushi. On a simple level, depends on the majority. If one min is a majority, that's the bracha, that's the ikar, and everything else is the tuffel. There's no chamesh laminim, I'm told, in sushi. Rice, or those bezonos, is not chamesh laminim. If there's no majority, it gets complicated. You have to figure out what the plurality is. And again, if there's three different brachas or two different brachas, if it's two, you probably follow the majority, two out of three. If there's three different brachas, it gets more complicated. So again, I can't cover all the possibilities. We'll leave it at that. Question number 10. If one washed, does one make a bracha on fruit during the meal if it is the appetizer, the dessert? Or if he's eating it with challah, how much challah must be eaten, must eat the fruit with? That's a very important shaila. Comes up on a regular basis. So if you look carefully in Shulchan Aruch, Simen, Orachaim, Simen Kuf, Ayin, Zayin, Sif Aleph, talks about these things. On a simple level, he says an appetizer is complicated. If you look there, and you look also in the Mishnah Berura, Kuf, Ayin, Zayin, there's an implication that if it's for an appetizer, you would not make a separate bracha. That's spelled out in Simon Kuf, Ayin, Dalid, Mishnah Berura Sifkaton, Lamed, Tes. It's called Ma'ora Tavas Halachal. It's an appetizer. It enhances your appetite. Then the psak is you don't make a bracha. It's a suffix. It's a machlokas and different toast in a bracha. So in psachim, it has to do with the karpas. Other areas, it's a suffix. It's a suffix bracha slahakal. So therefore, if it's an appetizer, the bottom line psak is you do not make a bracha. The dessert, the psak is you do make a bracha. But although this is the bottom line, there are some in-between lines I'll share with you very briefly. The Piskei Tshuvos says that, yes, this is true, quotes from other earlier sources by the Kama Sotir, grapefruit. People, the grapefruit for what we call an entree at the beginning of the meal, that's Ma'or Tavas HaMachal. But he says a sweet fruit, now that's become more common, to have a grapefruit, the grapefruit, they give you a cantaloupe or a honeydew. He paskins, that's sweet, that does not enhance your appetite. It is, in his words, Lekishut v'yofi, either to looks nice, okay. Okadei l'sader ha'ikul ha'kal shel ha'ochal ha'b'achakach. It enables you to more readily digest the food afterwards. It seems to me that even if he's right, that's what it does, it still would not require a bracha. The reason why if it enhances the appetite, doesn't require a bracha, consider part of the meal, because it's serving, in effect, the next courses. Here too, if it enables you to digest them more readily, for that very same reason that he says in Piskei Tshuvos you do make a bracha, I would say if that's true, you don't make a bracha. And aside from that, the Dirshu quotes the Chut Shani, Rav Nissen Karelitz, there in footnote 8, that in fact it is Ma'or Tavas HaMachal. That's what I thought. I thought that his facts are wrong. And therefore, in Kuf Ayin Dalet, he quotes footnote 42 from Rav Sternberg, Tshuvos HaNogos. Also, he says you should not make a bracha even on cantaloupe or honeydew at the beginning of a meal against those who disagree. So we go back to the rule of suffix brachos lahakos, not to make a bracha. As far as the dessert, which seems to be an open and shut case, the Dirshu, in footnote 10, quotes again from Sternberg, Tshuvos HaNogos, and Eidus, that the Chofetz Chaim changed his mind. And Besof Yomav, he did not make a bracha on what they called kompot, which maybe call some kind of fruit cocktail. And there are those who claim that he applied this to all desserts. He said that nowadays dessert has become such a common feature, it's part of the meal already. I'm told that the former Mashkiach in Ner Yisrael, Big Talmud Chacham, heard that from the Chofetz Chaim, and actually passed on the way for the yeshiva. Chiddush Nifla Benayra. We usually pass them, it says in the Mishnah Berurah. As far as the Eidus is concerned, so some claim that he didn't ever change his mind. When he was an older man, he didn't make a bracha because he didn't eat that much, and the fruit was an integral part of the meal that satisfied him. Not that when he was a younger, he ate the meat with chicken and kugel, and just had a dessert at the end. He ate very little. That's a some claim. I'm not here to substantiate either claim. I just said the psak, bottom line of psak is followed what Mishnah Berurah says. Fruit dessert, you do make a bracha. What if he's eating with challah? How much challah must he eat the fruit with? That's based on a Shulchan Aruch Kuf Ayin Zayin Aleph, that if you're a questionable case, you have challah at the beginning, challah at the end, even if you have some of the fruit in the middle, you would not be required to make a bracha. And there's some who actually do that for the fruit at the beginning of the meal. At the end of the meal, it's better to avoid that and just make a bracha. At the beginning of the meal, which is more of a legitimate suffix, there are those who do that. How much must you eat? Once again, I saw in the Dershu 14, a quote from Scheinberg, that's enough of a mashu of challah. Mashu of challah at the beginning, mashu of challah at the end, and even though you have in the middle, you would not require a bracha. Again, I should only use that where the halacha is in any event, note that they shouldn't make a bracha, such as I told you before, the fruits at the beginning of the meal. At the end of the meal, it's not advised to do that. Just make a bracha and don't look for challah beginning or end. Question number 11. Is it permissible to attach a talit to poles on Simchas Torah, creating a very temporary tent for Kol Hanorim? It seems to me that there are those who say it's always mutter because it's just the cover of the Alma. But the psak seems to me that it's only mutter if you hold it up with your hand, as is normally done. Four people hold up the talis with their hands. That's considered to be permissible because it has literally has no standing. It's just being held up by their hands. If that's the case, if the poles are also held up by their hands, and if the hands would drop, the poles would drop, then I believe the pole is an extension of the hand. It's no problem. If the poles are stationary and they're attached to something and no one's holding those poles, then in my view, we should not put the talis on top of such poles on Simchas Torah. Question number 12. May one auction a bottle of liquor from Simchas Torah to raise money for the shul? How about if one auctions his chus to pour it? Chas v'sholom. I repeat. Chas v'sholom. Liquor is no good. Liquor kills. Liquor destroys Jewish lives, destroys Jewish marriage, destroys Jewish children. The kiddush clubs are horrific. Recently was a cartoon video about kiddush clubs. A kid had his stomach pumped in the hospital because he was just copying what his father was doing, and the mother's is going crazy. Nothing should be done in the shul to encourage liquor. There are many shuls now that are gone dry, and more power to them. Okay, and not saying every shul has to go dry. If people want to have a little bit of liquor at a kiddush, I don't feel we have to launch a strong campaign against it, as long as children don't drink and as long as no one drinks too much. That has to be monitored carefully. If either of those two happen, you have to go dry. It's pikuach nefesh. It would be very, very wrong for shul to auction liquor or schus to pour liquor Simchas Torah. Bechlal, what does liquor do with Simchas Torah? There's an unfortunate conflation of Simchas Torah and Purim. Purim, I understand. You're supposed to drink, or they're only supposed to drink wine. You only owe to the mitzvah Purim and wine. Whoever drinks liquor or beer on Purim is over in Aveira. And if you drink it, do it at night. Even if it's wine, there's no mitzvah. And if you do by day, you should follow the Ramah. Drink a cup of wine and go to sleep. This drinking problem has become very, very serious in our community. And so therefore, it would be terrible for shul to use a bottle of liquor in any way, shape, or form for auctioning on Simchas Torah. 13. A homeowner living on a hill has a driveway on an incline. Call him upper. When it rains, the water runoff naturally flows into his neighbor's garden. Call him lower. And stone floor. The lower neighbor wants to build a retaining wall on his property, which will divert the water to stay on the upper home owner's side, causing pooling, possibly backflow, and damage to the upper zone. Is it permissible? One is not allowed to pask an adini moment as shayla in the absence of the parties, and I'm not going to give a specific psak in such a case. I'll just give you a couple of guidelines. One, at first glance, the Mr. Lower is allowed to build anything he wants on his property. Why can't he? Well, what's to stop him? It's on his property. He can build as many walls as he wants on his property. If the Mr. Upper will suffer as a result, no. What can you do? Upper should find a way how to alleviate the situation, either in cooperation with Lower or on his own. That might be the strict halacha. There's another major problem over here. If you look in the Ramah and Choshen Mishpat Simon Kuf Nun Gimel Sif Beis and Sif Tazayin, the potential we call Cheskas Tashmishim, that Mr. Upper has been having his water flow down onto Mr. Lower for a period of time. Doesn't say how long this is going on. And this may prevent Mr. Lower from doing what he would otherwise have been able to do at the beginning, because Upper has already established a Chazak. There's a big dispute in Ramah's Mesupik. Do you need a chazaka sheyeshi mataina? Those who learn the Cheskas Habatim know that if she's there for 3 years, you don't win automatically. They say, after 3 years, get off my property. No, I've been here for 3 years. Did you buy it? No. Get out. Chazaka sheyeshi mataina is no good. Cheskas Tashmishim, it's not completely clear. I'm assuming in this case, Mr. Upper did not buy the right to have his water go off on Lower's property from Mr. Lower, otherwise there'd be no Shaila. And if there was no such purchase, then there's a big question whether Upper has any kind of Chazaka in this case, because it's Einim Ataina. Some say yes, some say no. The Ramah seems to be in doubt about this, which clearly has a very major impact on the Halacha in such a circumstance. And since I'm not privy to all the details, we're going to stop here on this Shaila, because you have to get all the details before you even begin to contemplate giving a psak. Finally, 14. Can a patient who has had prostate surgery and now is connected to a urinary drainage bag daven and put on tefillin? Mishnah writes in Chelik Aleph Siman Chav Zayin, it's mutter. If you look there in the Piskei Tshuva Siman Ayin Vav Har 1, quotes a whole slew of poskim who agree with from Moshe's psak, and that is the psak halacha lemaisa. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Rebbe. We hope we can call upon you again in the near future. Thank you very much. Take care.
Bye-bye.